Welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
This week we're heading to Greenland via the exploratory mind of Dr. Joseph Cook. The microbiologist will be explaining why he's just made a new short film with composer Hannah Peel, documenting the slow transformation of the world's ice sheets and why it's something we should be doing our best to slow down.
We'll also be hearing from Boise, Idaho, where the home of the 20th century outsider artist James Castle is still revealing new treasures, around $1 million worth recently. We'll be speaking to Rachel Reichert and Byron Folwell from the city a little later on.
And we're off down the pub too. London-based photographer Tom Oldham will be returning to the Monocle Weekly to tell us why his latest project, The Last of the Crooners, is documenting the regular scenes captured at East London institution, the Palm Tree Pub.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking forward to next week's news. And we'll play some great music too. That is all coming up on the Monocle Weekly right here on Monocle 24. Here we are again.
And
Hi, Tom.
I said in the top of the show, we're heading off down the pub. I thought that was just me and you breaking out and going. Just under an hour, then we can do that.
Tom Oldham, I'm looking forward to him. He's been on the show before, hasn't he? I think you've spoken to him on this programme
before. He did an extraordinary... We sort of documented the longest day in London, whatever that is, sort of mid-ish June. All three sun taking a portrait every hour. They were absolutely fabulous, the pictures. So one can only imagine how good this latest iteration will be.
Before we get Fernando into the studio to talk about next week's news and all the rest of it, have you had a beautiful week?
Summer has finally arrived here in London town.
Should we get Fernando in here to tell us?
He's a positive human ray of sunshine,
isn't he?
Right there.
And you just know that he's going to be brightly coloured, and he's going to have some beautiful shorts on. He's going to get that. He's going to have the Augusto Pacheco legs on display. Isn't
Let's
he?
Get them out and him in.
There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando.
And here he is. It's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, welcome to the weekly. Happy Sunday lunchtime to you.
Happy Sunday. What an amazing week has been, right?
What a beautiful week. So beautiful.
You're both very tanned, I have to say.
Yeah, well, we've got the studio lit to our tastes, put it that way. What have we got?
Well, we've got... I hope you guys don't get bored with me, but this year we have so many Latin American elections. And to be honest, the most important are still to happen, which is Brazil, Mexico, Venezuela, Colombia. But we shouldn't forget Paraguay. It's quite a troubling country in some way. So I'm looking very keenly to this election. Because, you know, they had I think, the longest military dictatorship in the continent for 35 years. They had a political party called the Colorados. They've been in power for 70 years, including during the military dictatorship. So it's very hard for the opposition, you know, to be in such a country.
Yeah.
And this year, the election will be one of the candidates is from the current party, which is the Colorados. His name is Mario Abdo Benitez. And the other one is a bit more progressive, you know, center-left candidate called Efraín Alegre. The polls are saying that the Colorado guy will win, so things will continue as the same. But I think last time I was here talking about Costa Rica, I was wrong. And the progressive candidate won. So things... you know, can change.
Well, I was going to ask you about this because we've been talking a little about this during the preceding week. You know, is it a single issue election? Is there some big flashpoint? In that case, it was about gay rights, of course, was very front and centre in Costa Rica. There's not really one key issue. And I guess it's more about who's best placed to steward the country through times that remain rather, I don't know what's the word, turbulent.
Well, I think there's no key issue as we had in Costa Rica here. I think the main issue is the generational gap, you know. So Paraguay is quite a young country. And from what I can see, I think the younger generation are going to the opposition guy, Efraín Alegre. But you know, things are hard. And the Colorados, you know, they have the whole machine working for them. So, but it would be amazing if Efraín won. Actually, the only time that Paraguay had an opposition candidate, he was impeached. It was Fernando Lugo. So, you know how difficult it is.
We love an impeachment in this
country. God, South America loves a good impeachment.
Doesn't it love one? So it's sort of, it's kind of classic old school South American territory, then. Paraguay is one of the few kind of clinging on to the kind of military dictatorship or the friends of.
Exactly. And
if so I mean, this would be a good kind of, we could sort of sing to the tune of the new broom if Allegro were to get in?
I hope so. Okay. I hope so. I don't want to say anything live because I was wrong once. I don't want to be wrong twice.
I just like the idea of the Colorado. It sort of sounds like it might be a telenovela. Sort of sounds it might be the Paraguayan Kardashians. Yeah. I'm kind of a bit like them too.
But keeping up with the Colorado.
Yeah. Right?
But guys, one thing you need to have if you want to be a Paraguayan president, you need to speak Guarani. It's one of the few countries in South America that speaks another language that is not Spanish or Portuguese. So I think 90% of the population speaks Guarani at some point. And I believe there was one candidate, he didn't speak Guarani. And of course, you know, he lost badly. So yeah, do practice your Guarani.
Okay. Are you thinking of running, Tom?
I'll throw my hand to the mess.
Okay.
My next story is not about politics, but it's very relevant for the age we live nowadays, about superheroes, actually. You know, this Friday and over the weekend, the new Avengers is coming out. It's called Infinity War. And the reason why I'm saying this is because, you know, everybody has such high expectations about this film. The business side of things, you know, people are predicting it's going to be even bigger than Black Panther. And I wonder, because Marvel, they do no wrong when it comes to the box office. You know, they have good reviews, people like it. But I wonder if there's a little bit of a saturation happening. Because it's funny because, you know, Disney, who owns Marvel now, their main competitor is themselves, actually. So they have to change the schedule because, you know, they don't want, you know, the Avengers to fight against, you know, the new Solo, the new Star Wars spin-off on the screen. So it's such a weird world we live in.
Yeah, it's a proper sort of monopoly with that sort of side of the entertainment. And all the competitors seem to have kind of slackened off the pace a bit, or they're not, you know, the scripts aren't working, or they can't get the right sort of mix of stars or whatever it is. I'd be surprised with Black Panther. I mean, that was sort of something that was not only a good film, but sort of meant something other than being just a good film. And people loved it and were proud to love it, and that's not a bad thing. But with this one, this just seems like another superhero kind of. It's got sort of, it's, you know, from the franchise that bought you the franchise. It's the franchise.
And the Black Panther
with extra cheese.
The Black Panther's in there as well. They are selling, yes, actually sometimes as the sequel for the Black Panther. You
so
know?
Some so, of the same characters, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I wonder, we have to wait for the reviews to be, because I think they're still, probably they're waiting until closer to the date when the film will be released.
Have you seen the movie already? Or will you be at the IMAX?
I will be honest with you, I think I will, actually. Okay. Because it's part of my job. that was part of
okay,
my job.
Very professional.
It was
good.
Part of my job to watch Rampage on a Sunday evening, Leicester Square, 10:30.
Loosely, but yes, you're just about getting away with that.
Exactly.
Has Tom signed your expenses?
I haven't reviewed your expenses claim yet. How many popcorn?
do you like Marvel? Any of the Marvel films besides Black Panther, or have you seen them?
Yeah, I quite like Thor. Actually, I think they've been very entertaining films. I quite like whoever the actor is that plays him. He's not great in lots of things, but he's very good in that. I think it's kind of it's good. It's good crack. I think that
he's cheeky. I like it.
Tom's not moved.
I haven't seen any of the films.
You're the only one. You're the only one with an excuse, as you actually have
exactly.
a young son.
But. I did see Peter Rabbit recently. and it was terrible.
Yeah, apparently it was so awful. Yeah.
And it's doing very well.
I know. Well, I still sat through most of it.
I have a little trivia for you. Peter Rabbit, my beat Paddington in the box office, which was already a hit.
Well, in some sort of new MMA format.
Yes.
Oh, no, on the screen. Sorry,
on the screen.
That I would pay to see.
Yeah.
Excellent. Can we squeeze another one in, Faye?
Of course, you know, I have to fit in like a Brazilian story, but I think this is quite interesting. In a sad way sometimes, you know. Yesterday, São Paulo Fashion Week started. And it's funny because I remember about 5 years ago, São Paulo Fashion Week was one of the most important in the world. Some people said it was the fifth best, just behind, you know, of course, Paris, Milan, London and New York. But of course, we had, you know, a little bit of a tough economic crisis in the country. So we had to restructure the whole fashion scene in Brazil. We had the luxury of having two fashion weeks, one in Rio and one in São Paulo.
Yeah.
We were really booming, but it's not the case anymore. So it's a much smaller event. But I've been reading a couple of articles that, you know, the only good thing that it's becoming a more creative event. So on the business point of view, it's tough. I'm not going to lie. You know, it's not as it used to be. But, you know, there's more creativity. Smaller brands are able to showcase the work. So it's a little bit of what happened to London compared to
Paris and Milan. I was going to say, you've got that raw creativity where everyone else, especially New York, was all about selling suits and selling off the peg and all the rest of it. Paris had it. And London certainly felt different in that moment in the 90s when it was sort of boosted up kind of thing. So who knows? Maybe this this is the seeds of a kind of renaissance.
Yeah.
In that people, there's actually interesting, good stuff to see rather than it just being a very commercial.
Well, and how often do we see, and if we look at the visual arts, say, Rob, Straighten Times so often the instigator, you know, the yeah. most, often the best work, the most political work, the big leaps forward often come when, exactly when economically things are rather on a sort of downward turn.
Yeah, maybe politically as well, when there's a bit of turmoil that makes. I remember writing something for this radio station, in fact, saying Margaret Thatcher was the greatest accidental record producer of the 1980s.
Exactly.
Because of all this great stuff that was done, not necessarily in her favour, but you know, she was weirdly the progenitor of much of that stuff. Well, that's it then. São Paulo, I'll show my new collection. Yeah.
Please, you know, and of course they have excellent brands like Cotton Project, João Pimenta, you know, there'll be a lot of interesting stuff. And, you know, I mentioned that Rio, they don't have like an official fashion week anymore. So all the swimwear brands moved to São Paulo as well. So that would give a little boost as well, because we do great swimwear, guys.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely an editorial spread that I'd read.
Dr. Joe Cook from the University of Sheffield is a man looking at the future of the world's ice caps in minute detail. He's a microbiologist specialising in glaciers and ice sheets and how those regions are not so slowly melting away.
But he's also going further than most to communicate his findings, making engaging films, utilising resources from sponsors such as the Rolex Young Laureate Award. And his newest collaboration, Ice Alive, is a collaborative film with the composer Hannah Peel.
Hannah has soundtracked Joe's footage of the ice caps that he studies. In a moment, we'll speak to Joe, but first, here's a clip of that chilly glacial score. And Joe Cook joins us now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Joe. Good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you.
It's interesting. Is there something almost paradoxical about how beautiful these places are? The score kind of carries you there straight away, and yet they're under such threat. Is there a sort of a balance there that you strike in your work and indeed in these other endeavours?
Absolutely, of course. That's one of the major things that I wanted to explore with Hannah, actually, is this paradoxical sense of how powerful this giant ice sheet. This is like continent-sized. This is a giant, entire landscape is covered in ice, and yet it's threatened, it's vulnerable to our actions. And also, my work shows that they're vulnerable to the action of these tiny microscopic organisms that live on the ice surface. Isn't that amazing that something, the scale of an entire landscape can be influenced, threatened by something that's so small we can't even see it.
And there's something of that in the film, this sort of anthropomorphization of this ice sheet. We feel kind of, I felt like it was a bit like sort of a big white whale or something. And there was something, it felt like it was being pursued and we were kind of watching it somehow. Tell us about how you make the jump from making a very beautiful kind of artistic film with such a wonderful score from your scientific background.
There's a massive crossover between the two things, because both things are effectively a search for knowledge, you know, or a way to communicate knowledge. Mm. We can find things out. We can use scientific measurements and observations to learn things, find out how things function. But that's only part of understanding the environment. If we want to get a more complete understanding, like a holistic understanding of this beautiful, threatened environment, we've got to look at the intangible and the immeasurable as well. And that's why I brought Hannah into this collaboration, was so that she could explore the things that I can't measure as a scientist. And when we bring those two things together, we can try and communicate a more complete understanding of the environment to the public.
And is the emotion, because it's quite an emotional thing there. I wonder how you do that. Scientists, despite an emotive issue like climate change, are not meant to be. They are meant to be, you know, a different kettle of fish to the composer or the filmmaker, perhaps.
Science, by its nature, is supposed to be emotionless. It's supposed to be objective and not subjective. That's also to overlook a massive part of our understanding of the world. If we're going to engage the public and non-scientific communities in the debate around climate change, we have to use emotion. People aren't interested in something that's completely emotion-free.
Yeah.
So we have to find a way to blend the two things.
Well, and on that point, I know that something you've sort of mused on before is the fact that I guess people ask in some ways the wrong questions. And often the narrative is framed as, you know, oh, is climate change real or not? Not in these studios, I should add, but certainly if we look stateside, that's very much the driver. But your point, I guess, would be, and this, I suppose, is the scientist in you, is not is it or is it happening, but it's how is it happening and how are its effects manifesting themselves? Is that why you feel that need to go right down to this microbiological level?
Absolutely. The question around climate change is not, is it happening? That's a done deal. Right? We're confident about that. The question now is the details. How fast is it happening? How should we act? And how long have we got to act? We can keep adding data to the pile. There's a massive pile, a huge pile of incontrovertible evidence, and we can keep adding more and more data to it. But to an extent, what's the point if everyone ignores the entire pile anyway?
And is that the point we're still at? I mean, is this, I guess this is a huge sweeping ambition, but with works like this, are you trying to confront people with the immediacy, the urgency of that?
Yeah, to an extent. I'm actually an optimist. You know, I think that there's a growing groundswell of enthusiasm for climate action. I don't think we're technologically limited. I don't think we're scientifically limited. I think that it's now a question of politics and a question of communication. So I think there's a responsibility on people that are engaged in science to also be engaged in science communication for exactly that reason.
And I wanted to talk about the hookup with Hannah. You met under quite unusual circumstances. You're both guests on a radio show. You can tell us a bit about that. But her work, some of it's quite turbo. It's kind of like electro dance music. It's kind of a whole different vibe. That's an interesting meeting of minds as well.
Yeah, well, it all came around quite serendipitously, really. We were both guests on midweek on Radio 4 in the morning. And I was kind of aware of her music anyway. After the interview, we sort of chatted at Radio 4. And I sort of listened to a bit more of her music and realised that when she was writing her music, it was deeply analytical and scientific and philosophical. And also, I just like it. Yeah. I like how it sounds. You know, yeah. It's great music. So I thought, wouldn't it be amazing if she would apply that same depth of analysis to the changing Arctic environment? There's really deep, nested complexity to try and convey in the science. That just fits perfectly with Hannah's style of music making. And I thought there'd be no chance, but I'll reach out anyway and just see what she says. And you know, I was delighted and totally astonished that she was up for it. So it kind of built from there. I sent her a load of footage and materials and science papers, and we had a series of discussions about the science, and I tried to explain what the environment was like and how it was changing.
And that was before she'd written a note.
So that
all kind of went
anything.
Into it. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the absolute first step. And then I basically just left her to it then and said, just go away and try and communicate this musically, sonically. And she came back with that. And I was blown away.
It's amazing. Yeah. There's a lot of black keys in there. Some minor chords in there. There is something mournful about it. But
it's
very
moody, for
beautiful,
sure.
Beautiful yeah. about it. Yeah. Were you worried that you kind of think, hang on, you know, as you say, you need to kind of grab people by the throat. You need to get people's emotions involved in it. And this is certainly that kind of piece of music, right?
It's quite a deep piece of music. Mm. There's a lot going on in there. And one of the things that I was really keen to convey musically was this idea of nested feedbacks and superimposition and very intricate cycles that all build on one another. And I think Hannah's captured that with this sort of moody background, the synth, and all these small little delicate things going on top as well that all sort of feed into each other. It's just like how the ice sheet works.
I love a nested impact. Sounds like Pep Guardiola speaking.
Yeah, exactly. Joe, tell us a bit about your own experiences of being on the ice. Obviously, people are familiar with this idea of a landscape that's incredibly stark in some ways, but so rich in others. And the brightness or the darkness of it, I guess, literally and metaphorically. What's it actually like? I mean, presumably you still spend a lot of time in these extraordinary vast wildernesses. What is it like? Is it one of those things where it's very silent and quiet, but also very dynamic? Give us a sense of what it's like to be there.
When you first arrive, it's like stepping onto the moon. It's like nowhere else that you could imagine being on the Earth, because it's just ice for as far as you can see in every direction. Immediately, it looks blank. It looks white. It looks like a cartoon where someone's forgotten to draw the background in. You know, you just feel lost. And then after a few days, you start noticing landscape features, and you start noticing that the river channels are not where they were on day one, and you start recognizing the little hummocks and the little ridges and the little patches of color around you. Before long, you realize that you're actually experiencing a really rich landscape with lots of diversity and lots of change. Now, this is a landscape where we have the same features on ice as we have on land, rivers, hills, and all, you know, everything. But they're forming over the timescale of hours to days rather than centuries to millennia, which is amazing. You know, we can see all of those processes that shape our landscape, but sped up.
And talking of which, talk us through this sort of creeping darkness of the ice. This is a big deal, and this is speeding up. There is climate change itself, and then there is this sort of accelerated thing where these particles are burying themselves into the ice.
Yeah. So the scientific term you're referring to is albedo. Albedo is basically, it basically is darkness, but it's darkness in wavelengths outside of what we can see with our eyes as well. So it's all of the solar energy and how much of that can be reflected back into the atmosphere and how much is absorbed by the ice, and then that energy is used to melt the ice. And there's various processes that are going on that darken the ice surface, make it more effective at absorbing energy from the sun, and that makes it melt quicker. One of those processes is the growth of these microbes, algae, on the ice surface. And they're really, really dark. And they're really, really dark because they produce natural sunscreens to protect themselves from burning in the UV radiation on the ice sheet.
Oh, wow. So they're not only... They're doubly smart.
Basically. It's a bit of a microcosm for us, really. They're trying to create a comfortable habitat for themselves by changing their environment. And in doing so, they're accelerating the demise of their own habitat.
Do you ever get overwhelmed by the sort of weight of the symbolism? Because we're talking about these things like darkness you can't see and these creeping insidious microbes that are so successful they're destroying themselves. It's also, it feels like a work of fiction. Yet this is all going on and you're one of, I guess, a relatively small number of people who are charting it. Does it weigh a bit heavy, or do you actually like the fact that you're in this position where you can share these extraordinary dynamics with a wider audience?
Yeah, a little bit of both. It's an incredibly interesting problem to be working on. It's so rich in unknowns and problems to solve, which as a scientist, that's kind of paradise.
But it's not fearful, are you? This is it, I guess, the rub. So much of scientific breakthrough has been going into the unknown. But there's fear there, right?
Yeah, it's a scary topic, without a doubt. The background is how quickly we've got to act to save human lives and livelihoods.
Much more profound than that, I guess.
It doesn't, but you can't think about that on a day-to-day basis. That's always the context for the work. But ultimately, we're there as problem solvers, and we're there to answer small questions that contribute to a bigger scientific movement, I guess. And those giant questions, that massive symbolism you're talking about, that's why I need people like Hannah and people like the filmmakers that I've been working with, Proudfoot TV, to move in and fill the gaps that I can't fill with as a scientist, to bring the artistic expertise and the musical abilities and, you know, all that immeasurable, intangible stuff. That's not my forte. That's why I need those guys to come and help.
I'm really intrigued that one of the things you said at the top of this interview was, well, there's enough facts. You know, it's interesting how scientists kind of go, you've got enough facts, we can keep on finding facts, but the main fact is it's going to hell, you know, kind of thing. I mean, that's my finest scientific terminology. It's interesting to see that. And I suppose all of this work, all of this sort of what we might call extra work, is simply in service of the pure facts of the science, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't say we don't need any more facts. There's definitely a lot of science that still needs to be done and a lot of refining. I'm just saying that the basic message, the key message, is kind of well baked in. As time goes on, there's more of an imperative to communicate the science as well as actually doing the science. It's not okay just to go out and make measurements anymore and then discuss them amongst 10 or 15 other interested people at a science conference or something like that. It has to be publicly available, especially because a lot of it's publicly funded, so it should be publicly available.
And can I just ask finally, what is this kind of timbre of the conversations of climate scientists? Is there a bit of anger within your part of science?
There certainly can be, but when climate scientists get together at a conference, it's normally friendly, happy, upbeat, trying to have a positive impact and trying to discuss the new work and that sort of thing. It's really focused on advancement rather than dwelling on perceived injustices or anything like that.
Well, that's it. We like to be optimistic as well. We like to issue a call for action. Obviously, people should watch Ice Alive. How do they do that? And what else would you like people, if they're struck by your message and the kinds of things that they see in this film and that they hear, of course, in this piece, what should they do? Is it classic sort of think global, act local? What's your message to them?
Yeah, well, firstly, if you'd like to watch Ice Alive, and obviously I encourage you to, then you can see it on my website, which is tothepoles.wordpress.com. It's on there on the homepage. You won't struggle to find it. And what I would suggest that people do if they're interested by the film, if they're inspired by the film, is to go out and learn as much as possible and go to the more reputable climate websites. You go, for example, to the National Snow and Ice Data Centre. You could look at the National Environmental Research Council's website and follow links in there and just try and learn as much as possible about these systems. Find the bits that you're interested in, become an expert and contribute yourself.
Congratulations, Joe, on Ice Alive and Dr. Joseph Cook. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Time for some new music now. This is Jenny Fahl from Norway with Spells.
Casting some spells there. That was Jenny Fahl out of Norway. This is the Monocle Weekly.
James Castle was a self-taught American artist working in mostly found materials and creating drawings and books throughout his lifetime until his death in 1977. His work has gained a following from those interested in outsider art since then, with retrospectives in locations ranging from the Philadelphia Museum of Art to the Venice Biennale.
The city of Boise in the artist's home state of Idaho has been in the process of turning the artist's former home into a visitor space, but during that process have unearthed one more set of treasures that the artist left. 11 previously unknown works concealed in the walls of the house itself. We're joined now by Rachel Reichert, who's manager of the Boise City Department of Arts and History's Cultural Sites program, and Byron Folwell, who's project architect for the site and was there when the new works were discovered. Byron, we'll come to you about that discovery in just a second, but Rachel, maybe you can just give us a bit of a sort of background to why James Castle and marking his sort of legacy, if you like, in this way has been a priority for the city.
So the Boise City Department of Arts and History is really interested in preserving the city's cultural fabric. So that's taking arts and history and weaving them together through all kinds of different programming. It includes public art, it includes our city archive, cultural grants. And so this was a really great opportunity for the city of Boise to take it a step further and kind of offer all of those types of services in one place. When our director, Terry Shoresman, went to our mayor and council and asked if they would be interested in saving the James Castle House, we had unanimous support. There was no question of why we would be saving this house otherwise. So it was a great way to start this project. It's been about 3.5 years now in the making, and so we're just about to open next week on April 28th.
And Rachel, I guess James Castle is such a unique artist to the place he was in, to the state, to Boise itself, and specifically to this house. There is nothing more of a homegrown artist than someone that kind of rarely left and that was so bound up in the place in which they worked.
It's really funny. So locally here in Boise and kind of abroad in Idaho, a lot of people here don't actually know who James Castle is. But I learn more about people having an understanding of Castle outside of Idaho. So it's a really great opportunity to also just celebrate Castle here locally and educate our local population on why Castle is so important and what role he plays in American art history.
Well, we'll talk a bit more about some of his techniques and the man, I guess, in a moment. But Byron, let me bring you in here, because Rob was talking there about an artist who is almost part of the fabric of a place. And I guess this is the extraordinary dimension to this, these findings you made that were quite literally part of the fabric of the building. Tell us about that moment, because that must have been extraordinary, that moment when these treasures were revealed.
It was a cold December day in 2016, and there were four of us working in the house. We were opening the walls. looking for the configuration and condition of the structure. When we opened up one of the living room walls, there was a small collection of items, including the artwork.
That's quite an incredible thing. I mean, did it look like they had been stowed there or kind of lost down the back of the sofa? You know what I mean?
Everything was at the bottom of the wall, directly on top of the sill plate. It had been undisturbed, presumably, for about 70 years or more. It really did seem to be fairly intentionally placed there.
And so you had to go pretty slowly and carefully with the rest of the work you were doing in order not to disrupt any further treasures that might have been in partition walls or whatever as well.
That's right. We had sort of a process moving through the space, opening the walls to observe the structure inside sort of systematically. So when this was discovered, we were ready with a camera. Of course, every single time we opened up the walls, just in case there was something there. Fortunately, we were able to catch that on video when we did.
And Rachel, if I can come back to you, there's something strangely fitting, isn't there, about this? It's apposite that these pieces, these early drawings were found in this way. I mean, as Rob mentioned in his introduction, Castle himself used found materials. So, you know, the irony of these works that had that origin story then themselves being discovered, it does sort of fit with what we know of the man, doesn't it?
Oh, for sure. Even the house itself is built with found materials, and it became more and more clear as the project went on how the house and the very way the house was built is almost very similar or even identical to the way that Castle constructed pieces or worked in found materials. As we were discovering more of the house, we kind of made this really beautiful connection between the materials that literally insulated and built the house that he lived in are quite possibly the same materials that he was actually working on. So lots of found papers and cardboards and food packaging that appear in the house are the same papers that he would have worked on in his work.
Do you regard the house itself as an artwork?
That's a great question. So when the city of Boise purchased the house, we acquired the original family home, which is a small, about 2,000 square foot structure now. But in addition to the house, there was a small shed where Castle lived and worked for many years. That small shed was acquired in the purchase of the property. And we, by all means, consider the shed a piece of art for sure. And the house itself, definitely components of it.
Byron, maybe just picking up on that to you, did it change your approach to this whole project? Obviously, you're an architect, but did you sort of begin to take on a mantle of a sort of pseudo curator almost? You yourself had to be a part art historian. Was that a fun process? Has it changed the way you look, not just at this project, but maybe at others that you have worked on and indeed will work on?
Yeah, it was a wonderful process. It's a great opportunity for both of us. We're both Idaho natives to be able to sort of celebrate the kind of architecture that was built in rural Idaho at that time. These are hand-built structures, usually built by the homeowners with extreme care, with found materials. And we call that vernacular architecture, of course. That is an element and an approach to architectural study that I was very excited to be a part of.
So can you put a rough figure on these works?
The 11 pieces that were found in the wall are roughly in total valued around $150,000, give or take a bit. The James Castle Collection and Archive is the organization that manages the artist's estate. We returned those works to the Collection and Archive. They gifted them to the city. And in addition to those 11 works, they gifted 50 more works. And so right now we have this really beautiful collection of 61 artworks valued at $1.1 million.
Amazing. And tell our listeners about the James Castle House that's reopening with kind of renewed vim and vigor and extra features. And obviously, this is your work, Byron. When does this open?
We're really excited to be able to showcase the artwork inside the house. The artwork is hanging on the wall directly above where it was found. That's a really wonderful thing that we can open with in addition to the new works. We also have an exhibit planned for the back bedroom that sort of takes on the same theme as what Rachel was talking about before, the material life of James Castle, the kind of materials that he was surrounded with, the way the house was put together, the way the house was built, and the similarity with the way that his artwork is put together. So all of those things together, I think we have a really spectacular opening. There's so much James Castle here that has just never been seen before.
Well, congratulations both on the find and on this new iteration of that fantastic building. And thank you very much for your time. Rachel Reichert and Byron Folwell from Boise in Idaho. Thank you very much.
As debates rage over the gentrification of many well-loved neighbourhoods and landmarks here in London, one institution has weathered decades of change and done it to a fine soundtrack too. The Palm Tree Pub in Mile End in East London is as well known for its no-frills atmosphere as it is for being something of a reluctant tourist draw to those seeking a taste of the genuine British boozer. And part of its charm is down to the pub's regular music nights, offering good time jazz and swing performances by local regulars.
London photographer Tom Oldham has been capturing some of the sights seen at the Palm Tree for his new project Last of the Crooners, along with the musician and producer Andy Gangadine. It's a photographic series and also an accompanying vinyl LP, only available to buy from the pub, which he helped launch there last night. We'll be speaking to Tom in a sec, but here's a clip of singer Paul Wood in action.
Well, what a difference a day makes. What a difference a day. The difference is you. Yeah, the difference is you. And the difference is you. It's you.
Complete with chuckle, Paul Wood at the Palm Tree there, and Tom Oldham, I'm delighted to say, joins us to talk about it all. And you can croon your way through all or part of this interview if you wish, Tom. That's entirely up to you. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
You are a veteran, of course. We should start again. We spoke, I can't remember when it was, but one of the projects we mentioned was The Longest Day, you documented parts or faces from East London over a 24-hour period. And your draw, the siren song of the East End draws you back. Why does it remain? What's the enduring fascination, I guess?
The Longest Day was a real love song for me to where I shot and portrait every hour for 24 hours on the longest day of the year. And I thought I was going to be leaving East London and really wanted to try and get down all the elements that I really loved about the place. And interestingly, I suppose that I loved it so much following that project that I didn't leave. One of the people we shot at 10 p.m. on that project was Vow and Alpha at the Palm Tree in Mile End Park. And it just struck me that life evolves and changes and shifts. And the Palm Tree has been such a constant for such a long time for lots of people in the East End. And I've only been going there for about 17 years, so I'm kind of new in town. But I'm trying to make an impression. It really struck me that, I don't know, it just now felt like the time to try and document it. So I went in to talk to them and just did a couple of shoots and really loved the results. That you could, I could tell immediately just looking at the monitor when I was shooting that this was going to be something special. And I photograph lots of famous people all the time, and they have PR people and they have makeup and they have lots and lots of people around them to make them look good. And to apply that same value and aesthetic to people that showbiz and the lifestyle may have slightly passed by, but they still very much celebrated in the Palm Tree. They've got a pride to them and a beautiful attitude to what they do. And it was just absolute gold as a subject matter for me.
The pictures are just as beautiful as the voice of Paul Wood there, giving it right up at the top of the show. They're not pure verite, are they? They are quite styled. I mean, they're obviously part and parcel, but they've got your sort of signature look. What did your subjects think of the finished article?
Aesthetically, to just talk about that aspect of it, there are a great many stakeholders when you tackle a project like this. So there are the landlord and landlady, and then there's all the regulars, and there's the hipsters, and there's me and what I want those pictures to look like. So there's a great many people that really care about the look of this pub. So one of the things is that it's incredibly, has a lovely warm feeling. It's like a beacon and it's right out on its own, this pub. So you
it's
walk
like
there.
It's like a lighthouse, isn't it, or something?
That's right. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. So it's got a lovely warm glow to it and it's, you know, right by the canal. So it's pretty atmospheric down there. So you walk up and part of that atmosphere is because the lighting in there is astonishingly low levels, right? So they're really warm red lights. Absolutely impossible to photograph in. There's no camera you could just shoot pure documentary in there because it's so dark. So to tie in with the very well-known aesthetic of the place, Not that they've channeled an aesthetic to it. This is just what an East End pub looks and feels like, you know, but that's in photographer terms, that's how we sort of, you know, describe these things. We did use lighting. We did bring in lighting. I had, you know, two assistants and a digital operator. There was a team of four of us to create these images. But getting that look and feel was absolutely vital to the integrity of these shots. And I think that's why they've done quite well and they've been quite well regarded. And as a photographer, you see what's coming in and you think, yeah, actually, that's exactly what I really hope these could look like. And you think, and then there's this awful weight of responsibility that comes on you, like, oh, I've got to do something with these now.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no. So, hence, you know, this old hoo-ha.
And it's called The Last of the Crooners. And it's funny, you talked about you when you shot The Longest Day, you were thinking maybe you would leave the area. Is this a... It's clearly sort of a celebration. It's a testament as well. Is it a posterity piece? Is it something that's to record something that's under threat or is definitely going to go? Or do you feel reassured that there's something kind of enduring? Is there...
Yeah.
Does it have that longevity still now?
It was... The intention with this was that to document a thing that's no longer a thing, but it is still a thing at the Palm Tree. And it was very much an honour to be allowed the access to do this. So it was, like I said, to get it right was really important. But in terms of the longevity of it, who knows how long life is going to look like this, you know? And to have been able to photograph the people involved, they won't be doing this and forever. And longevity demands that not only the crowd change, but the artists as well leave the area, you know, the performers leave the area. So there are some, you know, slightly younger ones coming through in their 50s and what have you, you know. But I've shot a portrait of Helen Keating, who's an incredible singer, beautiful. And she used to do last Sunday of the month for 25 years. She did this, the last Sunday of the month. She was in The Sweeney. She was in Minder. She's showbiz.
That's cool, that's right? That's the two names you want in your...
Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I wondered if you could just sort of paint a picture of a night, actually, at the pub.
The East End of London would have been very, very commonly full of pubs with jazz singers. And with the intention of keeping people in the pub.
Yeah.
You know, and that was very much the plan with it. And drinking habits massively changed. And any black cab you get along Roman Road, they'll delightfully tell you about, on a Saturday night, this was like Shoreditch down here. It was absolutely rammed, pub to pub to pub. You could do pub crawls just on one side of the road, you know, along Roman Road. And it was a really exciting time. And but that changed and faded. The demographic changed. And so the Palm Tree is... has really done its absolute utmost to maintain that same feeling. They've been there for 40 plus years and it's nothing has changed. You know, when the smoking ban came in, they didn't take away ashtrays because they wanted it to still feel like the pub, you know. So elements like that are really intentional with them, that they just want consistent. I really admire consistency, and that's a big motivator for documenting this, I think, that it's just been the same for a really long time, and a huge amount of people have been local to the Palm Tree, you know.
And the idea of, you know, you as a photographer have an aesthetic, as an artist have an aesthetic. It sounds like the pub has one of its own to be
right.
About
you know,
that thing.
It doesn't take credit cards. There's no Wi-Fi. There's no TV, no food, you know, other than Christian snacks or what have you. And it's got a really beautifully sensitive, warm light. It's no, I mean, it's no coincidence. It's where me and my now wife had our first date.
Ah.
I was like, the darkness will only help me. And
I don't like to point out to our listeners, Tom Oldham is a very handsome, prepossessing man.
Good face for radio. But it definitely does have a very consistent aesthetic. We keep using that word, but a look and feel that is unique only to the place now, I think. And it's not a wine bar. It hasn't been scrubbed up. It's not shabby chic. It's just the way it is. And everybody's welcome there. That's the key thing. There's a warmth to it. And yeah, just make sure you get the cash point first.
Yeah.
Tom, can I ask you a little bit about the people you like to photograph? Because you already mentioned that the sort of there's an honesty, maybe a kind of integrity to shooting some of these subjects, certainly in portraiture, that you wouldn't get with someone who is being very looked after. Mm. And I will remember back to Longest Day again, there were these very sort of genuine portraits. Also, have you shot people recently like new dads? Did I?
Yes.
Is that,
I have to shot that. Yeah.
And there's something kind of disarmingly honest about those, because that is a person at a moment where they're completely stripped bare.
Yeah.
Do you prefer to shoot people like that, or is there something that appeals about the gloss and the glamour and the different challenge of shooting someone who's being very presented to you?
Well, you've got to take that one step further back to the career of a photographer, basically, that I have shot for a couple of brilliant organisations so far this year in India and in Gambia. And those people get the very same aesthetic treatment that we that when I shoot Richard Branson, say, or Usain Bolt. You know, they're the real heroes, those people that are just doing the schlep every day, you know. And that's where I really love to apply, you know, shooting on a beautiful Hasselblad camera and incredible quality files, because they're the ones that really deserve it. But in terms of balance of a career, especially financially, you know, I take on commissions and do jobs, and sometimes they involve famous people. You know, like last week I had the cover of Shortlist magazine with a Hollywood actor, which is really, really nice, and a lovely job and commission and a lot of fun too. But my real heart is in slightly more long-form things like this that are of my own initiating and with no creative director saying, yeah. Can you make sure you get the branding in? You know, like not having that kind of heat behind you is a relief at times, you know. But I do work. I am a jobbing photographer.
And Tom, do you find whether this is in your work photographing the famous or the people that maybe deserve more recognition and don't get it, but appear in lots of your pictures, like the people at the palm tree? Are there people that are just good at having their picture taken, that react to it and can kind of either give you exactly what you want or give you something you didn't realise you wanted from a portrait?
I think it's just the years that tell the story. It's in the, all in the faces, really. And for me, there's just a bit more engagement, a bit more
the
story
soul
to
of
tell.
Age there somehow.
Yeah, I photograph a lot for Mojo magazine as well. Yeah. So I've had the incredible privilege of photographing like Smokey Robinson for them and Ginger Baker, people like that.
Well, there's a face.
What an honour to be in the room with a guy like that. And we say yes to these things because we want the experience, you know. And what an incredible honour and experience it was to photograph the last of the crooners, you know, because they're the real deal. And they're not amateur singers, you know, they are professional singers that have worked on cruise ships, or they regularly roll around all the different venues that there are in London that have live jazz. And there are, you know, still some remaining, you know, so they're really good at their job. And it doesn't matter if there's 10 people in or 100, they'll bring the show. That's something I find really admirable. Anybody with a passion is immediately so much easier to photograph because it's all there in front of you, and it's my job to bring it out.
Finally, what's it like? It's nice to have an album cover, isn't it? I mean, you've come in and given Tom and I a beautiful LP here with it. I mean, there's something different about work ending up on that format. Yeah.
Well, if I'm allowed to say, the album has just been an incredible. It was really interesting hearing that Paul Wood singing at the front, right? Because it sounded really, really pub. The piano sounds so pub, but his voice...
The piano sounds it's not called a piano, it's called a Joanna.
Yeah,
no
it really
mistake.
Is. That's right, yeah. And every now and again, they will tune it also, which is terrific. So, but his voice sounds purely Vegas to me. I think his voice is all completely there. And there's nothing pub about that. He's a proper professional singer, Paul Wood, and it has a fantastic range and can pull up any of 100 of these songs at any point, and the band will go with him. And it's probably important to stress how we recorded this, because I don't want to get too geeky and too sort of Maplins about it, but we had wild mics above the band so that it was really important to record the room sound. And they didn't know when we were recording. So we had a laptop down in the cellar with all the barrels that could be basically, you could press record on that remotely, and we could start the recording and we recorded for about 3 or 4 months of every session, Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights, and then just edited. And so they didn't know when they were being recorded, which is very, very unusual in a format like this, because normally they would be in a studio in an environment like this and they would separate perform it several times, but they didn't have that option because we wanted it to feel like the pub. So there's 11 tracks on the album. It's a gatefold with all the photos in it, and there's a lovely little booklet of images in there as well. And we've really gone to town on it. I'm astonishingly proud of it. And that's the real privilege of this project. And to do that as in promotion of the photography is a lovely, lovely thing.
Oh, this is absolutely stunning.
Proper print.
Yeah.
Proper GF Smith paper.
Yeah, beautifully done. Look at this.
Hey, you see? Showbiz toenails.
Beautiful, yeah. Showbiz toenails. But also on the old pub carpet there.
Yeah, yeah, of course. That's
absolutely
right,
stunning.
Yeah.
Is there a kind of new generation of these old folks? Like
not
getting
really.
Up and singing on a Sunday?
Not
no?
so much.
Doing the standards?
Not so much. No, there's a couple of younger ones. Robbie Bell there, kind of coming through, but not really young people, no.
Do you think it can be sustained? It's funny, you mentioned, you know, sort of hipster demographic. And there's people who, I guess, critics might say, oh, they're consuming this cultural form in a sort of ironic way. Does that matter? As long as they're there, does it matter what sort of draws them in?
It's not karaoke, it's a seriously fun thing, and anyone who comes to the pub can't help but enjoy it. It's so loose and free, and it's not crap. You know, it's done with real sincerity and heart and passion, and people can't help but respond to that, I think. And whether that be hipsters or whoever, like, hipsters have got a discerning, and I think they respond to it really, really well. And it's always a surprise to see, having been there for so long, to see young people coming in, coming through and being genuinely surprised about how good it is. It's free, so anyone can go, just buy a pint, and sit down and get into it.
And indeed, it's not only us, Rob, appreciating this fine work. Tom, you are an award winner, recognised.
It's the Sony World Photography Awards 2018, and it's the biggest photographic competition in the world at Somerset House. And I've only gone and won the portrait category, which is an astonishing thing for me, because with these things, you get an email that, like, this is the last day to enter the Sony, what have you. And I just thought, I can face rejection one more time, and bunged in 10 of the images, and 6 of them are going to be displayed, having won the category at Somerset House, which is an astonishing thing for me. So I'm super chuffed with that.
It's such a beautiful thing. It's a great idea for a project, but the execution is stunning. Tom, thank you so much for coming in and talking us through it. Congratulations on the project.
Thank you.
And we'll see you down the palm tree.
Nice one.
And the Last of the Crooners LP is available from the palm tree. Head there and get your copy. You must do it. There you go, Rob. What a sweep that was. From the light and dark, as we learned, of ice sheets, to the dingy and yet illuminating world of the East End boozer, with a trip to Boise into the mix as well.
Pretty good.
What's not to enjoy?
Some all good different voices on there. Imagine sort of an old East End crooner having a chat with someone from Boise, Idaho, with one of the world's top photographers, hanging out with an amazing and very personable young scientist. Shall we thank our pals behind the glass? Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. And the Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thank you very much for tuning in.